Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me, as always, is Jason. How are you, Jason?
Hello, everyone. I'm very well. How are you, Brian?
I'm well. A little sad, and that is the point of this week's episode. We wanted to pay tribute to somebody that had a big effect on our childhoods, and that is author Terrence Dix.
Yes.
Who Terrence just Dix. Recently now, passed away, actually. That I should have maybe
and, that. And here's what we'll do with this, because I'm noticing as I'm starting to sort of peek in on other podcasts that people are recommending to me. I'm not a big podcast person, but I'm listening to things. And I hope that we do a pretty good job of, yes, we go off on tangents and we sort of have a secret language sometimes, but I hope that we do our best to, you know, stop tape and say, well, in case you don't know who this is, or in case you don't know what that reference is. And it's not in a patronizing way to say, well, you clearly don't know this, whoever's listening. It's in a way to sort of catch, you always assume that there's a few people in the room that might not get what the reference is. So, you know, on that note, Terrence Dick, for those that don't know who he is sort of synonymous with Doctor Who. In many ways, Brian, you got to meet the man, and I'll let you.
I've never met Terrence Dix.
I thought you met him at a show years ago.
No,
did you meet him in the '80s?
No. I wish.
Oh,
yeah.
You met John Nathan Turner.
No, I met John Pertwee.
You met John Nathan Turner in an elevator.
That's right.
Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. That's sad.
You're kind of ugly, and I was really sad. no, I've never met Terrence Dix. I wish I.
Okay,
had.
I thought you.
Yeah.
Me too. I would love to have met him.
Yeah.
I think the name was just always there. And I think,
well,
as a kid,
I
would see his name in credits sometimes, but I for me it was always the Target books. Like his name was more synonymous with the Target paperback, which, again, for those that you don't know, you know, a lot about the old Doctor Who stuff, was, you know, they were, which, again, and you can jump in here, Brian, because you know more about this sort of thing and paperback tie-ins. My understanding of most paperback tie-ins from TV shows of the era, or the 60s even, you know, the Avengers had a couple of paperback things, but they were original stories. They took the characters and they gave somebody $5 to write a paperback, and they wrote these little, you know, the prisoner had some. And so how many of these, as a rule, were those paperbacks that tied into shows, were those adaptations of episodes mostly?
No,
or were
actually,
they their own
thing? It could go either way. In the case of, like, a television show like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., they just created original stories for the most part.
Okay.
But, yeah, and the same with the Thomas Deutsch prisoner novels. And the Avengers, they didn't do the teleplays, but for Star Trek, I believe it was a mix of both. And I think, you know, if Terrence Dix has a counterpart in the Star Trek world, it would have been James Blish, who adapted several, many of the Star Trek teleplays to novel form. You've seen them, we've all seen them, you know. You know, Star Trek 1, Star Trek 2, and they have those beautiful paint background. I believe
those incredible paintings on the covers, those amazing paintings.
Which I honestly think that J.J. Abrams was paying homage to in the end of the credits of one of the Star Trek movies, because it really felt like those galaxies, you know, coming on the screen. So there, it was a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, and of course, in the 60s, Doctor Who had a few adaptations, but I think in the 1970s, those Target books, those are the things I really remember seeing at bookstores. they just exploded in the early 70s.
Yeah, so there was, before that you had, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in the mid 60s, the Hartnell era, there were two or three adaptations. I found it in a shop in Stillwater, Minnesota, in a used bookshop in Stillwater when I was about 12 or 13. I thought I'd fallen through a time portal or something. There was that small gray hardback covered, you know, Doctor Who in an exciting adventure with the Daleks, the gray dust jacket, the drawing of Hartnell on there.
Oh, wow.
And it was like $4 or $2 or $3. And I couldn't believe that I would come across this thing.
You're
in
luck,
a little
yeah.
shop in Stillwater, you know. So there was that one, and there were two more, I think, both
I think,
all
I
done by David Whittaker.
The Crusades was one of them. And
okay, the Crusades.
I think the other two
yep.
were historical, if I'm not mistaken.
And so other than that, then you had this big, you know, they put those three out, and then there was nothing, right, until the early 70s. And it sort of, did it launch with Terrence Dix doing one of them, or was it Malcolm Hulk or whatever? Who was one of the first ones?
I honestly don't know the exact history of Target Novels. And they may have originally just tapped the authors of the stories. I think that may have actually happened. But somewhere along the line, Dix just kind of took over, so to speak. So
yeah, he would have been script editor at the time, right? Had there been
yes?
Did he have any scripts that he had written that were stories that were produced at that point, or was he script editor in that Holmes, the Robert Holmes era, and everything?
Oh,
right?
No, he was script editor, not in the Holmes era. He was, because that was Robert Holmes used. Robert Holmes used a different fellow. He was the Barry Letts era of Doctor.
Barry Letts.
So,
okay.
Like he
okay.
started during the Troughton era, and then he got bumped up, which has happened a lot on Doctor Who, to the script. And he had a wonderful working relationship with Barry Letts. They were really close.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most important thing about Dix, is not only his Target novelizations, but how much he added to the lore of Doctor Who.
Well, that's the next thing I was going to say, was that, you know, other than the you know, I guess, you know, I didn't experience these books right when they hit in the 70s. I didn't see them until I knew the Pinnacle paperback in the late 70s, early 80s. There were 10 Pinnacle paperbacks. There were reprints of the Target ones. There were 10 of them that came out in America with different cover art, different
yeah.
logo.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
So
the things that
I
always
knew
came
those.
Away on PBS.
Yes, exactly. And I knew those before I got to know the Target stuff. But the Target stuff, you know, they had the dinosaur book, I think, and the making of the show, making
oh, yeah.
of a TV series sort of thing, and, you know, whatever. So, I was going to say, other than that, I mean, the magazine didn't hit weekly until 79.
Right.
But really having any kind of detailed information about the production or about, you know, backgrounds of things didn't really start to happen until it was sort of a monthly magazine in the early 80s. So these books were kind of the internet, you know, the Wikipedia of these characters, and especially the main character. More so, he was able to, you know, take those scripts, make them into books, and expand on stories or in the script. He'd pad them out, but more than that, he gave you more background on the Doctor and characteristics and little asides and things like that that maybe weren't in the show. And it, like you say, it built up the mythology of the character, I think, in the history of Gallifrey. And
oh yeah, I mean, here's some of the things that they list him to be under his, you know. The additions that he oversaw were developing Time Lords, the name Gallifrey. He created Sarah Jane Smith, Joe Grant.
Mm-hmm.
The term regeneration was first used in a Terrence Dix.
Okay.
The dematerialization circuit, the whole concept of that, the concept that the TARDIS is indestructible. That it can be remote controlled, that it has a telepathic circuit, that it may be sentient, because prior to that, I remember Troughton says something like, "My machine doesn't think," and then Terrence Dix kind of turned that around. And then Multi-Doctor Stories, of course, which he wrote, too.
Yes, he wrote. So he wrote The Three Doctors in 73, the anniversary thing. And wasn't the story, wasn't the legend that, was it him or was it Barry Letts, I forget, that had spoken to Trout, or had spoken to Hartnell on the phone or something and said, "Are you interested?" And Hartnell was like, "Shit, yeah, I'll be there. What time do you need me? When do you need me? What do you need me to do? I will be there. I am so in for this." And they're like, "Great, fantastic." And then apparently Hartnell's wife called them back and said, did you talk to Bill about doing some Doctor Who thing?" And, "Oh, yeah, yeah, he's on board. And he's, you know, we're writing the character now. It's going to be the three of them running around." And she had to say, "Look, you're not going to get what you think you're going to get. Like, he's not in very good shape." And that's when they sort of had to pull back on what he could do and then just shot those, you know, those two scenes. But legend had it, either he or Letts were on the phone with Hartnell, and he was like, "Yeah, what do you need? It's great, I'm in." And they thought it was going to be the three of them throughout the piece, you know, through the whole story. But so he wrote that, wasn't that story sort of a big info dump of things that, you know, sort of added to the mythology within that story?
Oh, wasn't absolutely. There a lot of little signposts? Like, it's, you know, it's Omega, right?
Who showed
up later as a baddie.
Yep.
I honestly think that, getting back to his Target days, I think where he was writer of the fourth Target book. And if I'm not mistaken, the first three are just reprints of the 60s novelizations again.
Okay.
Because you've got Doctor Who and the Daleks, you've got the Zarbi, and you've got the Crusaders, which I believe were printed in the 1960s as well. So he writes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The first thing he wrote was Doctor Who and the Auton Invasion. And I remember that book. I remember some of these early books had cartoons in them. Do you remember those?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. Yeah,
actually,
I don't know why, but that was the original story was Spearhead from Space, right? And they retitled it the Auton Invasion.
They would do that originally. Yeah, it would always have to be Doctor Who and the they did that. So Dix was kind of sharing, like, Malcolm Hulk was doing a lot at that time for the Target books, and they seemed to be swapping authors quite a bit. And even Barry Letts got in on it and wrote one. And then it seems to switch probably around the time that Dix leaves Doctor Who, and they start adapting the Tom Baker stories, and he just starts to take over, basically.
Right, right. And that becomes sort of his main gig.
Yeah. And I remember reading an article with him a couple of years ago in Doctor Who magazine, and he was saying he still gets royalty checks.
Well, he's in one of the making ofs or one of the extras on one of those DVDs. He talks about, you say how prolific he was, but he was saying in this thing, like, "Oh my God, I was doing so well with these books and the checks that were coming in. But more than that, I was going and making appearances all over America."
Yeah.
You know, I was going to all these shows and stuff. And it was like this train that he thought was going to be never ending. And he's like, "I wish I'd have put some of that money aside now," but he really started to benefit from the association and, you know, writing all those books. And he would do those things that, you know, everybody sort of talks about, is the descriptive stuff about each of the doctors. You know, you might have artwork on the cover, but it might not be of the doctor. And so when there'd be that first scene of whatever doctor it was, he had these very interesting descriptive phrases that he would use for each of them. Like, I think Davison had like a, you know, an open face or clean open face or something. He had these strange sort of, you know, bohemian, I think he used for Tom Baker's character. You know, or something else for Trout, and they were sort of these standbys that he would put in there. But then because the last thing he wrote, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought the last script that he did was State of Decay, Is that right? In 81?
Yeah, but wasn't that his last State story? Of Decay actually meant as a much
yes, it was.
Older script? Like, yeah.
It was going to be a, I think it was supposed to be like 77 or 78, and at the time, BBC was doing some big Dracula adaptation.
Right, something. Right, that's it. Now, I mean, yeah, Terrence Dix actually wrote The Five Doctors.
Five Doctors, okay, that was 83 then.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's probably his last one.
Okay. And he just was the go-to guy to write The Five Doctors. It just made sense that he would be
there. I don't think that's how that happened. As I recall reading, he absolutely... they could not figure out a script, and they eventually just, like, ran to him, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I figured he would have been one of the first... Because of the Three Doctors, they would have said, well, you know, call him. But I know that there were a lot of problems with that because of the Tom Baker thing. There was a lot of back and forth between John Nathan Turner and Tom Baker, and Baker was in for a good chunk of the back and forth. He was going to do it. And then he sort of, I think it was kind of his FU to Nathan Turner and the show and everything. I think he strung them along and then said, you know what? I've thought about it some more. I don't think I want to do it. I don't think it's a good idea for me right now. And then that put things into sort of overdrive. They had to get the script down.
I think the Five Doctors actually started out, this is what I was reading right now, is that it started out as a Robert Holmes was the writer. And then
yes, that's right.
So they
that's
they
right. And he walked away, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't he got pissed off at the way they that's right. It was, I remember, who's the guy, Eric Saward. He apparently bitched about that script. Or he either defended him or he bitched about it, or Nathan Turner didn't like it, or I don't know what it was. But people were kind of shocked that, you know, they were nitpicking at the great Robert Holmes, and he got pissed off. And that would have been his last script, I think, right? The last thing Holmes did? No, he did. Didn't he do The Two Doctors? Did Robert Holmes do The Two Doctors?
Oh,
is that him?
I want to say yes. I hate The Two Doctors so much.
Awful.
Yeah.
Terrible. So bad. So bad. But so you'd always see his name. I mean, it got to a point in the early 80s where we sort of knew when new books were coming out, that, you know, the one or two bookshops that I could go to that carried the stuff.
Yeah.
And like every third book seemed to be Terrence Dick. You know,
it did. In fact, the first one I read was from the Whitby Library, and it was The Mutants.
Okay.
I didn't know what doctor it was. You know, and I hadn't seen the episode itself. So I read that whole book, and I can honestly tell you, when it did finally play The Mutants, I was really excited, because I think it was like, I read that in the sixth grade, and they played The Mutants around the seventh grade. So I'd waited a year to see this adaptation, and I was really disappointed with that kind of... early 70s production values, because in my head it was Star Wars, you know? And I remember honestly being very disappointed by it, but I read a ton of those Target books in the 80s, and most of them were written by Dix. He was just synonymous with it, you know?
And what's interesting about that, well, certainly where I lived, was that, you know, we didn't get the Pertwee stuff. It was like that we had the... There's great radio interviews you can find of Tom Baker in like 78, you know, being interviewed with Mary Tam and talking about what they're doing this season or something, and saying, oh yeah, well actually it's just been sold to America.
Yeah.
You know, with the interviewer going, really? Oh, that's interesting. You know? And so that was right around the time that the Baker stuff was hitting. Well, we didn't get, then there was this dump of like Pertwee, all the stuff that existed of, you know, Pertwee, Hartnell and Troughton. And then some of the Pertwee stuff was black and white. That hit around, I want to say 85, either 85
or
86, where suddenly all of that hit PBS. They got this huge package of all this stuff and ran. So up to that point, I had never seen footage of any of these people. You know, I had read a bunch of these books, like Inferno was one, because Inferno was one of those books that didn't come out in the 70s. It didn't come out until like the early 80s or the mid 80s or something.
Yeah, it had a terrible cover. I remember that.
Yeah, the guy in the lab coat melting or whatever.
Like,
yeah,
it looks like a depressed person on it. Yeah.
Yes. But I remember reading that and then seeing it and, you know, having that sort of buzz off of, you know, having read the story first. And so I picked up a lot of that stuff that I'd never seen. I had no frame of reference for how these people sounded, really. Troughton, I think I knew what Troughton sounded like because of The Omen. Because I knew that was the guy that was in The Omen. Because I'd read a bio or something in one of the magazines that said he was in this movie. But that was it. Like, I had never seen these people in action. You had probably seen The Three Doctors by that point, because you saw all the poetry stuff, didn't you?
Yeah,
by the mid-80s?
As a kid, I saw not The Three Doctors, but they had a weird... The way they got away with playing Doctor Who on TV Ontario was they would have a show after it that discussed like the science of it. It would make it semi-educational. Nice. And I remember they had a guy, I think he was called... He was a real doctor. Like, he was a real scientist. He was called Dr. Dater. And he would talk about different things. And I would sometimes watch the Dr. Dater segments just out of, like... I don't know. I didn't want to change the channel. I was a little kid. And
there's nothing on. There's nothing else on. I might as well.
Yeah.
Somehow this is slightly related to Doctor Who. I might as well keep watching.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't until when they went to Baker, they switched to an author by the name of Judith Merrill. And she actually hated Doctor Who, and she called herself the Undoctor. And she was like, you know, so she would just, you would couldn't change the channel fast enough because she was crapping on it. And but I remember Dr. Dater actually showed clips. He was talking about Doctor Who and science behind it or whatever, and he showed a clip of the three doctors. And I can remember just being a little kid going like, oh, you know. And then later on, I think I'd seen, or before I'd seen, the Doctor regenerate, and it was, you know, so I kind of didn't. I remember that being very impactful at the time, and you know, and of course, like, the one doctor looks like Mo from the Three Stooges, and you're a little kid, and, you know.
I at a certain point, I only had those Pinnacle covers.
Yeah.
And on one of the on the Seeds of Doom, which I think Terrence Dix wrote that adaptation. He didn't write the script for the show, but I think he wrote the adaptation. Tom Baker's on the cover. I think he's on the cover of two of those Pinnacle ones. But there's a Pertwee story, and I think it's like Day of the Daleks. What's the one with the Ogre?
Well, that's
the time travel.
Or Planet of the Daleks. One of them has like a King Kong on the bottom.
It has like a King. Yes, it's like a King Kong, and the Pertwee face is like, he looks like kind of a hippie with a tash. He's got like almost like a mustache in the middle of the book.
Yeah.
On the middle of the cover, and so I didn't know who the hell. I just thought these were all to do with this one guy. I mean, he was the show, you know. I don't think I really understood probably until not long before, you know, like the Peter Haining book came out. Remember the Peter Haining book, that came out for 83. I mean, that was the Bible. That was, outside of the magazine, that was one stop shopping for every bit of information you could want about
the Peter
the show.
Haining book and the Radio Times book. They were really helpful.
And the Radio Times.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And it wasn't until like a couple years later. So I think, if I'm getting this right, I saw Pertwee and Troughton in the Five Doctors story written by Dick. I saw them in that before I saw any of their
stories,
their original stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure, which is bizarre, but, you know, but it was cool to kind of be able to soak all that stuff in. Let's talk about the stories that he did write, stuff he did write for television, because I think he wrote, did he write Horror of Fang Rock? Is that him?
The one I remember the best that he wrote was, Robot.
Yes, Robot. He wrote that, was Baker's introduction.
Yeah, which is such a seminal episode, and one I'm very fond of. Actually, I think that's one of the best, Doctor Who's that's been done. That whole season's just magic.
Just him, you know. Even in Robot, Tom Baker is nearly fully formed from the moment he sort of shows up. He knows exactly what he's doing, and it's a marvel to watch. But then it was just that whole, like, it was story after story just got better and better and better, and it took it someplace. I mean, I think Ark in Space was that Baker's second story or his third story?
It's his second,
which
story.
Is Robert Holmes.
Yeah.
And I think they said that there were like 10 or 11 million viewers for that story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a wonderful, seminal, scary episode. So here's Terrence Dix's writer, Doctor Who writings. He only wrote 35 episodes of the show, which is...
35 stories? I mean,
no,
35
episodes, not...
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, he wrote two episodes of The Dominators, I think three episodes of Seeds of Death, so, you know, he's just kind of coming in uncredited on those. And then, of course, he wrote The War Games with Malcolm Hulk. And then his first actual, like, you know, he was the script editor for 5 years on the show, but the stories he wrote are almost all Baker's, which is Robot, The Brain of Morbius, which is very pithy, Your Horror of Fang Rock, which is one I'm not fond of, but you are.
I love that story. I love the whole Agatha Christie, you know, 10 Little Indians, or, you know, what, you know, that riffing on that, and the lighthouse and the creepiness. And I just came across, I just had a kick to watch some of this stuff not long ago.
The glowing green lighthouse keeper in that is always kind of silly to me, but.
Well, the creature, the bad guy.
The Rutan.
The Sontarans, whatever. The Rutan is ridiculous, of course.
It's a cabbage.
But I'm more watching it where everybody in it, like, you know, these people are acting in a thing. They were jobbing actors. Oh, you're going to do a Doctor Who? Oh, great. Okay. From everything you hear about the making of these shows, it was from the moment they said go, nobody could take a breath. Like, the rehearsals, the shooting of it, they brought it right up to, you know, 5 minutes to the end of the day or 6 o'clock or whatever they could do.
Yeah, yeah, that's a famous story.
You know, building the set, and all with the budget of about 50 pounds, you know, to build, you know. And when you're watching it, of course you hear them go up the stairs, and then you know it's wood that they're walking up. They're not in the location, and you know whatever. But you look at these wonderful actors that are in these things that are just, you know, acting their heads off. I mean, they're just brilliant in these parts. You know, for a thing that they must have thought, this is going to air Saturday afternoon, and then 3 weeks after that, you know, the other three episodes, and then no one will ever talk about it again.
Yeah.
Like, we've done our job. We came in and we're in this show and we did it. And then, no, you know, but you wouldn't know that from the performances. You feel like they know they're a part of something very, very special, but it's just that they were all very good actors, all usually, you know, classically trained and stuff. So I watched it and I thought, this is everybody in this. It's just great. And the, you know, it's one location and a couple of different rooms, and Baker's just on fire. You know, he's just amazing in it. So I have a lot of affection for that. So wow, I didn't know it was only 30 some episodes. So Robot, Brain of Morbius, which I freaking love, and Horror of Fang Rock. What came after Horror of Fang Rock that he did?
Oh, sorry, I was looking at some of the other stuff he did. Right after Horror of Fang Rock, it seems to go right to State of Decay and then The Five Doctors.
Wow, I swear, I thought he did more stuff.
No, he didn't. I think it's because he's associated with all those books. He also wrote a couple of Avengers episodes.
Yes, yes.
And he wrote one Space 1999, and if I recall correctly, he didn't even know that got made. Like, he wrote it, and I think some fan said, hey, I watched the Space 1999 you made, and he was like, oh, that got made? You know, I don't think he thought it was going to get through.
What do you think of that episode, whatever episode it is?
I got to tell you, it's an episode called The Lambda Factor. And
Lambda?
Lambda, like in Lambda, Lambda, Lambda. And I have absolutely no memory of this episode at all.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and I've seen it.
Interesting.
I just don't think it's a second season episode.
Okay.
I think it's one of those episodes where they're trying to save money, so they film it all, you know, on the set, you know. And
we have to say something else about Terrence Dix. I'm sorry to jump in, because I forget. So you and I were talking about this just before we kicked this off, which was, you know, we'd seen pictures of him, you know, we'd read interviews with him, and it wasn't until the DVDs sort of started to happen, where you'd have these extra things on the DVDs when they finally came out and stuff, that I knew what he sounded like.
Oh, yeah.
And what kind of storyteller he was. He, I don't know what the thing is called, but Terry Jones has, to a degree, where Terry Jones, very it's very subtle, but Terry Jones doesn't say his R's very well.
Jonathan Ross sort of is probably always, the most famous.
Jonathan Rossi, you know, he's got that little...
Yeah.
But Terrence Dix is very much like Jonathan Ross. I mean, it's that pronounced.
Yeah.
But he is such a good storyteller. He was so great at, you know, the memories that he had and remembering all these things and, you know, Robert Holmes. And he'd always tell these great stories in these interviews about, you know, making him very honest. And I remember him always kind of taking shots at Terry Nation.
He's
not in a mean way.
He is. He is a wonderfully flippant type. And that's one of the things I really liked about him, was that kind of impish, mercurial recollection. Like, he had a sense of humor, and he loved to take shots. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he took some J&T shots and other things in one of his later interviews. And you know, he's not being a dick, but he's just speaking his mind, and I like that about
him. Honest.
Yeah,
he's just sort of being honest, and he seemed to have a lot of affection for Baker.
Yeah.
And certainly for Pertwee, but he would also, you know, he'd be the first one to sort of criticize Pertwee and his sort of arrogance and, you know, lack of, you know, he took it too seriously sometimes, or a sense of humor or whatever. And he always had that sort of way that he could poke a pin in something, Terrence Dick. He was a great storyteller.
Yeah, he's a slight bit cheeky, I think is the proper term. He liked to be, and I kind of like that about him. And I love interviews with him.
Oh, he's wonderful. He's got the thing that he can't do the R's, and he's got the honesty, and he's always kind of chuckling to himself.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was one of the, you know, I'd say, because he worked with Hinchcliffe, and he worked with Barry Letts, and he worked with Douglas Canfield, and he worked with Courtney and Pertwee and Troughton and Baker and Sladen and all these people that are so important to the mythology of the show.
He also kind of felt like a gatekeeper.
He's one of the last guys.
Yeah, but he also felt like a gatekeeper for the show, like somebody who, a historian. He clearly loved Doctor Who. And he clearly had his own opinions of how it should be run and how, you know, one of my favorite things that I can give you as an anecdote for Terrence Dix is, I'd say around the late 90s, you know, interest in Doctor Who had picked up again and original novels were starting to hit, especially after the McGann movie. And my interest in the show was peaked again, and, you know, thanks to VHS and that sort of thing. And I picked up a novel written by him called The Eight Doctors. So takes place, you know, 5 minutes after the TV movie.
Okay.
And the first thing Dix does is blow up the TARDIS control room. And he has the Doctor, who is now injured by the explosion, run back to the familiar old, like, Tom Baker set. And I remember just thinking, like, oh, that's just bias. You didn't like the set in the TV movie.
Right.
Because he goes on long tangent of, the familiar white walls. And, you know, like, it always made me laugh because it's just such, like, well, we'll just sort this out, you know.
Did he do the, who did the, because this came into a story. Might have been the Fang Rock thing, I forget. But, you know, we talked about this once before, I think, that secondary control room, that wooden control room that is sort of... I'm not sure. I must have heard at some point where that idea came from. But I just think it's so... strange and so amazing.
I love it.
That suddenly somebody, it's just, it's bonkers. It just, it's only a few stories. Somebody said, let's do this. It's only a few stories. And it just added this other layer that they never really explored too much more in the original show.
Well, I think what happened was the set warped. I think that's what I heard. They wanted to do more with it, but the set warped in over the summer months.
But it's such a bonkers idea. Like, of all the stuff for them to say, you know, what's something different we can do in the show now? Let's change the opening titles, or let's do, you know, whatever. Somebody had this idea to suddenly, something that was never mentioned ever before in the entire history of the show, and suddenly do this beautiful, you know, steampunk, or whatever you want to call it, but, you know,
it's like Captain Nemo's submarine. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's brilliant. But Dix, I don't think Dix did that. I don't think he wanted to.
No, that was definitely the Bob Holmes era.
But all these guys, too, speaking of when the show came back, you know, and I think this is another thing that sort of, besides the DVDs and all the extras that were on the DVDs about the stories and stuff, that got Terrence Dix back into the consciousness, all these guys, Mark Gatiss, Russell T. Davis, Gary, what's his name, Stephen, blah, blah, all these guys, whatever, all the writers and the people that were involved with the new show, all of them would go on and on about Terrence Dix and how much he meant to them and how much his writing influenced them and how much those books were a part of their childhood and loving the show so much that he was sort of synonymous with the show. And so that sort of got him back into the show circuit, I think the convention circuit, and you know, Q&As and things like that, and all the younger generation of producers and stuff just loved him.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it has a lot to do with him being a very convivial person.
Yeah,
but yeah,
and now one of the I think next to Hinchcliffe, he's got to be one of the last guys left. Maybe who is the effects guy? What's the special effects guy's name?
Oh, I love that guy, Matt.
Just love him.
Yeah,
I could listen to him all day too.
I know he's so, Matt. He's so, but, yeah.
Matt Irvine.
Yeah, that sounds right. He's so.
Oh.
He still has like boyish enthusiasm for what he did. You
he
know?
Does.
Yeah.
He's in these interviews, the modern interviews, and you can still picture him in like, you know, cut off denim shorts,
the mullet,
and a tank top,
yeah,
mullet. You know, working on a robot.
Yeah, making a spaceship for $6. and yeah, he's so happy to be there. I love his DVD extras.
Love him.
By the way, Dix's Eighth Doctors was the best-selling Doctor Who novel for a very long time.
Oh, really?
It was a best-seller.
And he wrote, this was in the wilderness between.
Yeah, this was the
TV movie
when Target lost it and Virgin,
right,
took it over.
Virgin, and he wrote a bunch of those. Didn't he write a bunch of new books though?
I believe he did. I think he did one with, he did some stuff where, like, there was a new Troughton season, things like that. And he also, do you remember Doctor Who Juniors? He wrote those, too.
I remember those.
Yeah, I never had any.
Do you remember that there were some Doctor Who Choose Your Own Adventure books?
I don't think I ever got any of those. I did have, like, one of those Doctor Who Explores Dinosaurs. And it's just like
Doctor Who explores your body. Yeah, it was
Doctor Who touched you.
That wasn't Doctor Who. I'm sorry, that was Doctor Love. My bad. Yeah, that's a different book. There was Doctor Who. Yeah, explores plankton or whatever.
Yeah,
there were two or three science, real science ones, and then one that was about the monsters.
Yeah.
And it came in the poster or something. But then they had to do these two or three educational ones.
Yeah, they had these educational ones. Yeah, exactly.
Did he do the, did he write the, do you remember the two, anytime that, they, I mean, we were, I mean, I know we're going on about this and we got to wrap it up, but we were so starved.
Oh, yeah.
For any kind of merchandise, anything. You know, I remember ordering the damn balsa wood police box model kit, the Doctor Who Fan Club of America.
You mean you bought a box of balsa wood like I did? Yeah.
I bought a, yeah, it was like a bag of, or a box of Ultimate that was never going to get made. Yeah. I was never going
to
put it
because
together.
Because you had to be so like a skilled carpenter, you know, to put this thing together. Like, that was like a crazy person, you know, wasn't thinking it through plan. You know?
So was the. Do you remember what a big deal it was when the magazine started talking about not only the metal figures, the fine art casting stuff, but that a new Dalek model kit was coming from this company. Seventh, a Dalek construction kit, and it turns out the seventh guy was like, you know, Stuart Evans, whatever his name was. He was making these things like in his basement.
Yeah.
Somehow he got a license from the BBC.
And he had a vac
form machine. Put a sticker on the cover. And a vac form machine. And I remember finally getting that thing and opening the box and like never. I just opened the box, looked at the parts, read the instructions, put it back in, taped it back up. Never made it. I thought, I don't even know someone who could make this.
Well, yeah,
it would never
that
get made.
Box of balsa wood might still be at my parents' house. And I don't want it.
So we're starved for this stuff, and then you know, in whatever year that was, 83 or 84, I mean, we're probably both like 12, 13 or something, trying to find anything on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And they had those two other books, Terry Nation's Dalek Special thing.
Yeah.
I think it was a book, and then a thin paperback, and then there was a K-9 one, which I thought was written by Terrence Dix. Is that written by Terrence Dix?
I don't know.
There were those two, and then they reissued The Making of...
Yeah.
Which was written by Terrence Dix and had Baker on the cover. The original one had Pertwee and the Sea Devil or something on the cover, and then the new one had that Baker art on it or something. But even in those little books, there were bits where you could cut out, you could make your own paper canine or paper Dalek.
Yes.
You know, and so you'd make copies of those and then get colored pencils and try to build them and, you know. But I think Dix might have had something to do with the K-9 book, too. Or
the Adventures of K-9 and Other Mechanical Creatures was, in fact,
yes,
I believe, written by Terrence Dix, yes.
There you go.
What
there
a wonderful go. Cover.
Right?
Even on the cover, even on the cover, Tom Baker looks bored.
His drawing is telling kids not to buy this book. They'll just be bored.
Yeah. I hardly endorse this, children.
And they got along too. I think he got along with Baker very well.
I think he
they
did.
Were always sort of.
I think the strongest relationship was him and Barry Letts, though. They were like best friends.
Yeah, there's a great. I think the two of them are interviewed in one of those DVD extras, one of the making of type things. There's a sit down with them, and it's just wonderful the stuff that they remember, and, you know. Just great stuff. So he's a legend, what a life. What a cool thing to be associated with. And
well, I'm very grateful for Terrence Dix, because in that time, that was the only outlet to Doctor Who for me was these books. And he wrote in a great style. He's a decent writer, but he didn't write. That went over my head when I was 12. He knew his audience.
Right.
And he definitely was a decent guy. And one of the heartbreaking things I thought was reading an interview with him where his father was never proud of him. And, he took it well, saying my dad was a working class guy. He didn't understand. But that's kind of heartbreaking for a guy who really encouraged a love of reading for me and, you know, brought me to another world and inspired me. I mean, I wouldn't be here without some small participation by Terrence Dix. You know,
what a legacy too. The list that you read of like all the things that he brought into the mythology, the ongoing mythology of the show that's still an ongoing thing that he's responsible for.
He got to see it. I'm glad he got to see the renaissance of the show. And many of his ideas become like canon and lore. That's got to be amazing. It would be really hard to put a fingerprint on Doctor Who now that he's done, because it's all been kind of done.
Right. And also you've got a lot of cooks in the kitchen. You've got a lot of different people that have done you know, but the list you read was kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
The number of things that sort of weren't there and then existed because of him, or terms that he put into stories or in the books or whatever that became canon, he would be one of the, you know, most associated, right up there with, you know, Verity Lambert and, what's his name? You know, the Canadian.
Sidney Newman.
Who came up with Sidney Newman and the other guy, and, you know.
I always love to say the story that Sidney Newman had an office like six blocks from my apartment, and I didn't know, you know?
It's so incredible.
Yeah.
It's so incredible. Imagine if you'd known.
Yeah. He said like a little office on Bloor Street, and it's like, are you kidding me? The creator of Doctor Who was around the corner.
You could have been running errands for him, running numbers.
I'm sure it would have gone horribly wrong, but, you know.
There's a story there. There's a great script there. You should write it.
Brian and Sydney.
My neighbor, Sydney. Well, we wanted to do something for Terrence Dix because we loved him, and he was a big part of our childhood, and never got to meet him. I thought Brian had, but I was wrong.
No.
But we never got to meet him. So
I know recently somebody wanted me to, a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to see Eric Saward speak at a local pub. And I was like, nope, not fond of him. But I would have gone to meet Terrence Dix. Absolutely. Would have loved to have.
Well, you're like, if it's Christopher Bidmead,
yeah,
give me a call.
Yeah. Oh,
I'll
yeah.
Be there for
yeah.
That.
Yeah. Cause I need a good night's sleep. I'm rather
Matthew Waterhouse.
What's that?
Well, Matthew Waterhouse is speaking at a coffee shop. Do you want to go? No, I'm good.
Yeah,
I don't need to.
There was speaking of Matthew Waterhouse, it was a double feature with Eric Saward. It was also the guy who played Eric Adric's brother.
Adric's brother?
Yeah,
brother.
In Full Circle, he has a brother. And the actor who plays Adric brother, I think, lives in Toronto and may have been having Eric Saward over. I don't know how this spectacular doubleheader, but it was like,
you know,
yeah.
You know what that makes me think of is I've told this story before, and I'll end it with this: like going over to the UK the first time when I was like 11 or 12 or whatever it was, and I really thought, I've said this before, but I really thought that there was going to be Doctor Who merchandise
everywhere.
On every street corner.
Yeah.
Like, it was going to be the Star Wars of the UK. Like, I'm not going to have room in my luggage. There's so much stuff I'm going to take back. And not only was there nothing but the chocolate Easter egg box, the Davidson suture box, which was ridiculous,
yeah.
Which I bought.
Is that the one where he's got like a
book? Yes. Yes, that's the one. Okay. The Dalek Ray is his schmanz. And then there were Madame Tussauds had the big display thing, which was incredible because I came around the corner and, you know, like, what the fuck? And all of a sudden, it's all Doctor Who, had no film in my camera, of course, missed all the photos.
Liar.
When you got
you
spat
never
out,
saw it.
When you got spit out at the shop, when you came around, when you were done, I thought, oh, there's going to be a ton of Doctor Who stuff. There was the Easter egg box thing, and there was the Viewmaster thing. With Baker, a drawing of Baker on the thing, on the card, and the Viewmaster reels were full circle. And of course, I look at it and go, "Well, this is a story I've never heard of.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see this.
It looks amazing."
And I remember getting home and putting those slides into the Viewmaster thing, and even as a 12-year-old, clicking the thing and just going, "Oh, this looks shit.
Yeah,
this looks terrible." What is this? I mean, they could not have picked a less exciting, the entire history of the show, that's the one bit of merchandise they decided to make for Viewmaster.
Yeah.
Was Full Circle. And then they did it one more time. They did it again. They did Viewmaster one more time, and it was for Castrovalva.
You know, the last Viewmaster just wasn't boring enough. I want inactivity on these slides.
Give us something exciting next time. The new guy. Something with him. He's fresh faced, blonde. One of his, you know, explosion type shows. Castrovalva. A friggin' show about Matt or Escher.
There's not even a monster. on Castrovalva.
Even a monster. There's nothing to
that,
look at.
It must have been like three reels of people standing on white sets looking around.
Wearing curtains.
Yeah.
Wearing curtains.
And like what's the big reveal of Castrovalva? Isn't it like
Adric is give me a minute. Let me think. There isn't one.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to that story.
Well, you know,
I don't think there is a
thing about Castrovalva. It wasn't written by Terrence Dix.
Right. That's true. We can't blame him for that one.
No, thank you for not writing that, Terrence.
On that note, right. Thank you, Terrence Dix.
Thank you, Terrence Dix. Thanks for listening.
This is a mini, but sort of a maxi mini, an in between. It's like not the bite size Snickers, but like the fun size. And the next time will be the full size Snickers. And we promise you, we've got two or three things lined up for Halloween, for October. We might even do three episodes for October this year.
As soon as we can get it straightened out, we're going to talk Halloween big time.
I haven't told Brian this yet, but I think we might do three episodes for October.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right.
I'll do it. I'm down.
That's our meeting.
All right.
That's our production meeting.
Yeah,
all right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.